and welcome to Dialect. I'm Ella Mapes. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, we speak to Tom Dewey, a Bristolian poet who talks about the importance of poetry and the poetry scene in Bristol. Tony speaks to Chris Hewitt, a journalist with an enthusiasm for transport, who discusses why we don't have trams in Bristol anymore. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at Dialect Radio, that's one word, .co.uk, and based at the People's Republic of Stotescroft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
Hello, everyone. I'm here with my friend Ella.
Hello.
And we'll be talking to Tom Dewey today about his relationship with poetry and the poetry scene in Bristol.
So, Tom, just so people get a general kind of idea of who you are, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Of course, yeah. Tom, I was born in Bristol. I'm 24. I sort of bumped into spoken word accidentally when I was 19. Started doing it then religiously. I've been lucky enough to perform at the Bristol Old Vic, at the Roundhouse. I think I'm still the youngest ever winner of the Bristol Open Slam, so that was good.
Wow.
That's yeah, that was actually my third ever time on stage. That was a wild day. I have a TEDx talk that's on YouTube.
What's that? How can we find that?
If you type in Tom Dewey, how poetry saved my life, or just TEDx, or both, that should bring it up.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks, yeah. So I thought we'd start off with your personal relationship with poetry, and I just wanted to know when you first got into it.
So I first got into spoken word poetry, I'd say 3 or 4 years ago, and that was because I was invited to go and watch a poetry evening. I'd never been to a spoken word event before, hadn't actually heard a spoken word at that stage.
What is spoken word? Sorry, just so people know.
Sure, yeah. So spoken word poetry is something that it's similar-ish to page poetry, right? But it's a slightly different form in that it's performed live. It's done on a stage. Those people are sometimes published too, and people can sort of walk both lines. But it's poetry that's performed live to audiences, like a music gig, basically.
So after the first time you saw spoken word on the stage, can you remember your sort of first drive that you wanted to get into it?
Yeah, do you know, I remember that really, really well, actually, really well. It was one of the strangest experiences of my life. I went to this event, as I say, kind of by accident, as a tag along, and going into it not thinking I'd get much out of it. And I very, very, very clearly remember sitting there for the first time ever and just coming away with the realisation that I had to do this at least once, but I thought I would do it once.
What was like the click for you? What kind of caught you onto poetry? Because I know a lot of kind of young people might see, like, how old were you at the time when you
I went? Was 19 at
19
the time.
So yeah. I know a lot of 19 year olds aren't going to view poetry as the most exciting thing. What was the thing that got you hooked
to spoken word? It was so radically different from poetry that I'd studied at school, partly in terms of how I'd come to experience it. You know, I didn't enjoy school particularly, and you associate it with having to go along to class and please read this and read a row, whereas this was something I'd gone to on my own free will, more or less. Mm-hmm. And it was brave and bold, and it felt new and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of why I felt then that I had to do it, that I'm afraid I can't explain at all.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense now to me, just in terms of how much I've ended up loving it, but I still couldn't really articulate why or what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Without sort of venturing into terrible cliche about fate and calling and that sort of thing. Yeah. But that is what it was. You know, I just sat there and went. And I remember even almost being annoyed because I was so frightened of doing something like that. But I knew that I had to. So it was as if there was two of me in that moment going...
Why were you frightened?
It's terrifying, you know. I'm not a person... Previous to that, I'm not someone who gets up on stage, and that was never me. You know, I was pretty introverted.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat there at the very first event. I didn't perform at this event. I just experienced spoken word for the first time. And I thought, oh, damn it. I know that I have to force myself to do this. I don't know why. I just need to. This is something I'm going to have to do at some point. And I'm being immediately terrified, but excited as well. Mm-hmm. It was a strange feeling.
That's amazing.
I came back. So that was at a monthly event on Gloucester Road, actually, a slam. And a poetry slam is sort of competitive poetry. It's not actually competitive, obviously. But
competitive. Poetry would be competitive.
Well, it isn't. And, you know, you laughing, it shows how sort of silly that is. But the reason they invented that was it was a way to trick people into going along to poetry nights. Because if you preface it with an exciting word like slam, you know, it has the effect of bang or crack. People just are drawn to it, you know.
Yeah.
And then they arrive and are horrified to find out they have an hour of poetry. So it was a monthly slam that I first attended. Mm. And I went back the following month and bottled it completely. Sat there and didn't perform. They said, you know, does anyone want to do it? I said, no. Could you sign up on the door for that? Right. Went for the next 2 or 3 months in a row, and each time said I'm going to do it, and bottled it every time. I'd written something after that first event. Mm-hmm. And then eventually was courageous enough at that moment, yeah, I'm just going to go and do it. Did it. Was lucky enough to win that slam. Nice. And then that was kind of, yeah, yeah. It was odd. Very, very odd experience for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can relate to the kind of the strong impression that spoken word especially has had on you, because my experience was similar of like poetry that I learned in school was quite stale, and like the kind of, or the way that it was taught to me anyway, it wasn't very captivating. And so when I went to a spoken word night, seeing it performed by people my sort of age with such kind of like energy and with a looser structure as well. Mm. That's what I think I found very, I don't know, it connected with me.
Can I just ask?
Of course.
What kind of poetry do you specialise in then? Do you have a kind of speciality, or is it just kind of anything and everything?
So I can probably answer that best by saying what I don't do, which okay. might be an odd answer. But so I write spoken word poetry. What I haven't, at least so far, done is written anything that's socio-political.
Okay.
For whatever reason, because I'm actually quite politicised and quite engaged, but for whatever reason, in spoken word, those two things have always been separate for me in my own heart, you know, not to say anything about what other people should or shouldn't write. Mm-hmm. But for me, when I've sat down and felt the need to write a spoken word piece, because they're things that happen to you rather than things that you create, you know, mm-hmm. they're odd. It's a strange process, writing, you know. So they've been about personal experiences, not always that direct, often allegorical or metaphorical, but the sort of course of my life since that first event has been that I've bumbled along quite happily. Some I've usually of my own doing, you know, I've bumped into some ridiculous catastrophe, dusted myself off, written a spoken word piece about it, performed it a few times, dusted along quite happily, bumped into some wall that I built, and then, so it's been that, it's been experiential and, mm-hmm. and deeply personal, actually, and cathartic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, would you say that there is a link between poetry and politics?
There certainly can be. Whether there is innately between the form, you know, is politics poetic sometimes? Other writers have drawn that link successfully, I think, you know. So people can write brilliant political poetry, I think. For whatever reason, those two worlds haven't collided in my own head, mm-hmm. for whatever reason. But, yeah, I spend almost 50-50 time engaging in politics and then writing poetry. And for some reason, when I sit down to write, that isn't what comes to me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you said it was cathartic. Can you say more about the role that it plays in your personal life?
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, I don't know what it would be like if I didn't get to write a spoken word piece after one of these catastrophes of my own doing, usually, you know, I encounter. But it's expression. And it actually, I find, can teach you more about how you feel about a situation than you realised. Mm-hmm. It's one of the strange things about poems, right, is that they occupy this kind of dream space. It's like they... Sometimes you can write something and sit back and go, huh, I had no idea that I thought that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like dreams, you know, dreams are the birthplace of thought, right? And that's true, sort of symbolically, but it's true also just biologically.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually how thoughts work. Things start off unconsciously, and the lower part of our brain, and they seep up slowly, and that often happens in dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And art in general is sort of the birthplace of culture in the same way that dreams are the birthplace of thought,
mm-hmm.
I think. Very therapeutic for me personally, because it means as well that, say, some terrible event happens, right, and I write a poem about it, well, I'll feel slightly better having written the poem. That's good. But then also 2-3 weeks, months, years later, when you have a dark night of the soul and you're remembering that terrible event and you're shaky of, oh, where do I stand with this, how do I feel about this, you can recite your own poem to yourself, or at least just remember that you'd written it, and you go, oh yeah, there, and it's boxed, it's finite.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it's a cliche, right? Overthinking, people consider overthinking, generally that's a bad thing. When you've written a poem about it, you can't overthink. You have a set number of words, they're already written and rehearsed and memorized. That's the event, that's the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, it's memorized, it's got a box around it now, it's complete. And if the poem itself is a journey through it, then you can guide yourself through that
mm-hmm.
as many times as you'd like to.
Do you think that anyone can write poetry? Because it's kind of seen as this, for some, this kind of unreachable middle, top, high class kind of thing that only kind of rich, well-spoken people can write. Can Seriously? You write poetry if you're from any background?
Hell to the yeah, you can. No, that's for sure true. I'm from a working class background. I'd never encountered any art whatsoever till I went to that spoken word event. I'd never been to the theatre, never been to an art gallery. No one in my family plays any instruments or speaks any languages, or, you know, the whole world was foreign to me. I firmly believe anybody can, because when I then started doing it, and almost overnight, from not knowing anyone in my social group or from my school who could play any instruments or who was interested in poetry or went to art galleries or did any of that stuff, suddenly all of my friends were like that. And it's a very jolting experience. It can be uncomfortable. It can be more difficult, unfortunately. In what ways? Because it seems less natural. That's how it felt to me, at least. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm wrong, because I can only speak from one side of that. But it felt to me, it was a very jolting experience to be suddenly... It didn't feel like something I was naturally destined to do. Didn't feel like, well, you know, I feel like if you grow up with people around you who are engaged in the arts, then you never know a world without them, and you consider that expression, and you could perhaps come subconsciously to believe always that anything you had to say might be worth hearing, because everyone you know expresses themselves in some way and it's listened to. And you can carry yourself like that, and that's, I think, healthy. Coming from a working class background or any background where you're not, your mind hasn't been furnished with that beauty from a young age, it can be odd and daunting. And you know, certainly early on for me, certain conversations at dinner parties, I was just quiet on. I was like, I can't reel off these film directors and compare who I think's. But you know, my life until I was 19 was football and the pub, and so that can be hard.
Mm.
But to answer your question, yes, absolutely anybody can do it. Poetry is blind in that respect, as a spirit, as whatever poetry is, because it is its own thing, and it comes into and out of people. It seems to exist on its own, not physically. But no, I don't think that poetry itself discriminates.
So what would be your kind of key advice to people who do want to break out of that shell and kind of push their boundaries and do something that they're by no means comfortable with?
Mm-hmm. Be courageous. Not easy. Go along to events, watch things on YouTube, and just remember, you know, the world needs you. It really does. So be brave.
I like that.
Be brave. Yeah.
So looking at the Bristol scene, there's several poetry nights that are very well attended.
Yeah.
What do you think about the social function that they play?
Well, I think experiencing beauty together is something that can add sort of fortitude to a friendship or a relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that you have friends, and when you really go through things, if you travel together or if you go through this thing together, it can kind of harden the friendship. And I don't think that has to be tough times. I think that can just be emotionally impactful times. I think that's a distinction that can be missed in that sort of discourse, you know. So I think attendance of poetry nights, for once, for the individual, it furnishes their mind, as I say, with beauty. Mm-hmm. It means that it takes you out of the rut, and it reminds you that there's this thing up there. And it's great for communities. It's good for people to get together. And for me, as I say, I bring it all into beauty. That's partly because of... that's partly because that's primarily what I get out of it. But it can as well also, of course, for socio-political causes. You get a lot of poetry nights. Spoken word poetry is quite tied to socio-political causes. So if people are getting together for a fundraiser, for an event, or, you know, that kind of thing, that can also be great because it helps to promulgate and action like that. Mm-hmm. And it gets people together.
Do you think young people have grown disassociated from poetry? There's so many distractions nowadays with social media. Some would say there's kind of not really much point in poetry in that respect.
Yeah. I think that was more true 10 years ago than it is now. I think that spoken word is exploding, it looks like.
Why do you think that is?
I think that, I mean, that's an extremely complicated thing to diagnose to any, you know.
Or can you better
particular cause? But I
distinguish how poetry as a form of writing and performance is what it offers the sort of prose or non-fiction or even just fictional writing.
Mm.
What do you feel like it kind of brings that other forms don't?
So people tend to answer that question by saying that, well, poetry is denser. It has an ability to pack big ideas into few words. And that's true. But for me, because I enjoy plays, I enjoy novels, and I enjoy poetry, I think what distinguishes poetry from those forms is its honesty. I think that whilst poetry is, like plays and novels, sort of wrought, it is crafted and edited, great poetry seems to give the impression of being a spontaneous soul cry.
Mm-hmm.
It can, whereas great plays and novels, they feel crafted. They're mm-hmm. things you have to sweat over and work on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in that way sort of can be detached from the wild, raw,
mm-hmm.
primal emotion of whatever was in the writer's soul mm-hmm. at the time. And I think great poetry can portray that at its very best. It's incredibly honest in a way that I think the other forms can't really be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Like graffiti, yeah. Right? Poetry can be like that. It can just have this, even though secretly it actually is wrought and edited and edited and edited like those other forms. At its best, it doesn't seem like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like someone just cried it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. How do you feel performed poetry compares to poetry on the page, and how do they differ?
Sure. So, in general, if somebody says there's a poem in front of me and it would take 3 minutes to read, is it a page poem or a spoken word piece? If you bet on the spoken word piece, you'd be right 80% of the time. So they tend to be longer.
Mm-hmm.
You get short spoken word pieces and you get long page poems. But in general, spoken word would be a bit longer, and on the page it would be more pages.
Mm-hmm.
Another difference is in formality, I would say. You can be more informal in spoken word. The big difference, if you're a writer, certainly, the main consideration when writing both forms is that you can, a reader, audience, can reread a page poem as slowly as they like. If you're writing a spoken word piece, it has to, so to speak, hit mm-hmm. at once. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the primary difference in terms of depth or complexity. Mm-hmm. You can get away perhaps with making a page poem more difficult to get to the heart of, mm-hmm. because somebody can mull it and take time with it.
Yeah. So you're going to perform a poem today.
Sure, yeah.
If there's anything you want to pretext it with, then go for it. But if you just want to crack straight into it and then talk about it after, that's good.
Sure, okay. This is a spoken word piece I wrote a couple of years ago. It's called Kites. And I wrote this when I had to sort of make a decision in my life. I wasn't living very well, and I wasn't surrounded by the best people. Well, good people, but people that I could no longer be surrounded by, unfortunately for me at that time. And I had to more or less stop partying. It was more severe than that, but that would give people an idea, you know. Mm-hmm. And so what I did something I realized when I immediately had to stop hanging around with basically all of my friends and stop doing what I'd always done, or what I'd done for a long time, I felt a real grief. It felt like a mourning for me. And who I was mourning the most actually was the me that used to do those things, right? And so what I did, as any good poet would, is take the me that had been, so to speak, killed, take all of my friends who I could no longer see, put them into one person, address them as you, mm-hmm. and write an apology for killing them, basically.
Yeah.
So that's roughly what this poem is about. And it was also inspired by Carl Jung.
Yeah. the psychologist.
Yes, yeah.
Cool.
It's called Kites. At the funeral, I realized being peaceful does not mean being harmless, that cowardice is no cousin of kindness, that no honor is to be found in not shooting somebody if all you have is a gun without bullets. When the barbarians came, the sandstorm in my throat was kicking up answers. The city was incinerated, a swirling smoke signal we packed in our spine. Brother. After the blaze, we rode our pregnant horse to the empty parts of this sun-stroked land, past multicoloured wishing wells trading pennies for yesterday, barely escaped with our not-quite life as white boulders on green fields rolled down toward the cliff. This is how I will remember you. Kissing a cigarette, riding away from the flames, spilling a silhouette, right in the place that we prayed. And on God, we prayed. Flattered the future with footprints. Lived as though the clocks had stopped. But we saw firsthand how the second hand fooled us. How we never ran full thrust. How the devil sang sawdust into an epigram chorus. And yes, the off-key melody of fear was with me on the day the days began to outrun us. The wind whispered in my ear of the barbarians' fury. Blood dripped from their tongues at the taste of my brother's name. From this I kept him, watched him at the watering hole, carrying himself like a burden, a flawed theory waiting to be ripped apart. Better to die quickly, brother. Better to die quickly. The barbarians arrived, and I was one of them, standing over my brother's corpse, the city spilling out from his spine, my tears adding salt to the stab wound, smoke billowing from his back at the funeral. Brother, the flames climbed high, turned your eyes into ashes. I waved goodbye to the times I'd imagined. The day you died, I cried like a klaxon. Thought that life was a bastard, for aligning a phantom with a blinded assassin who put a knife in your back and flies kites in a vacuum. White lies start to blacken. Limelight is an acid. Zeitgeist we abandoned. Time flies and it's tragic. But hindsight is a lantern whose light shines backwards. Cyanide over cancer. The right kind of disaster. I'm just finding the answers. I'm just finding the answers. I'm just finding the answers. I'm just finding the answer.
Wow, that was amazing.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks so much.
That was so good.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
You could really hear the rhythm and the kind of tone, and it like really set the scene just kind of hearing it. It was really cool.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem.
That was intense. Thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
And if people want to hear more of your stuff, where can they go?
Sure. So I've got a few things on YouTube. I'm Tom Dewey. Dewey is like the decimal system. It's a Delta Echo Whiskey Echo Yankee. And if you YouTube like Tom Dewey poetry, then a few things will come up. Most recently, an almost 10-minute love poem I wrote. So
yeah,
you have that to look forward to. Yeah, and I'm not on Facebook. I'm on Instagram as Tom James Dewey, all one word. So cool. You can find me on there. Give me a follow.
Sweet.
If you'd like.
And as for nights, there's Milk Poetry, that they are a resident at the Wardrobe Theatre, which is a part of Old Market Assembly. I think they have their on once a month there. There's also Tonic Bristol, which is a little bit different, where it's more kind of for the exercise of poetry. They will take a prompt 1 month, and then, well, people will choose prompts, and then the following month they will come back with poems inspired by those prompts. I've been to that before. It's lovely. And also next month, you've got the Lyra Poetry Festival, or otherwise Bristol Poetry Festival, which is from Friday the 13th through to Sunday the 22nd, and there's loads of things going on with that. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Anytime. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Chris Hewitt. I've been a journalist for 45 years. I've worked for local papers, the nationals, business magazines, radio and TV. One of my hobbies is transport, and I'm particularly interested in railways and trams.
So, Bristol trams, it was apparently a famous city for trams, and some trams, I mean, for example, even going up some very steep streets that we'd now look at them and say, well, there's no way a tram could get up there, and they probably wouldn't be able to get some of the modern trams up. So, can you say something about how Bristol fits in with Britain's tram history?
Well, the reason you had most tramways laid down was because Lloyd George, in his first budget, changed the rating system for railways. That's about 1905, 1906. Now, railways did have a monopoly, which some of the companies were abusing. Now, they originally rated the same as farming land, which means you only paid rates on the buildings, not the land they owned. This gave big urban places like Bristol, all the big cities, lots more extra rates. And the councils then went and started building tram systems because they got them on the continent. And this is the reason why so many local stations, urban stations, have shut.
So, but didn't trams first start as kind of horse-drawn trams, and then go over to electric ones?
Yes, that's right. Trams were indeed horse-drawn, because that goes right back to the early days of the coal mines, of which Bristol had at least half a dozen.
Okay, so when did the electric trams come in? And were they mostly done by the municipalities, like the council?
That's right, yes. They came in post-First World War, because they went from horses to having steam-hauled trams, which surprises a lot of people. You know, you have something going chuff, chuff, chuff along the main road.
So why was it that it was the municipalities, the local government, that was making up these tram lines and not
because
the...
Because they had the money to do it under the vast amount of extra rates the railways were having to pay.
Well, that's right, isn't it? I mean, one doesn't even dream of this sort of thing nowadays, but I know Birmingham, many years ago, in the late Victorian times and the early part of the 20th century, were actually building massive viaducts and aqueducts and bringing water in from Wales all the way into Birmingham.
That's correct, yes. Yes, well, Wales has got plenty of water.
There was even, apparently, in Bristol, a municipal plan to build a barrage across the Severn to generate electricity.
That's true, but I think you'll find that Bristol's main reservoir is at Blagdon, which did have its own railway service.
Okay, so at what stage do you think we could talk about Bristol's trams as their heyday? Was it between the wars?
Yes, all the urban areas, the heyday for the trams was before the war. The problem they had was there was no standard gauge. I think there were five or six different gauges. Now, if they'd all been built to the 4'8½ and with the same height from the track to the overhead wires as Blackpool did, they could have all bought the English electric balloon trams, which Blackpool's got a few of. These hold 120, which is more than almost any bus in the world can handle. It's effectively twice the capacity of the average bus. And these would actually very quickly get rid of all your large crowds at rush hour and going to sports matches and days out and all the rest of it.
So why were trams more popular than the bus?
Well, I think the one thing you got was, of course, that before the war, most buses were single-deckers. You could sit upstairs in the tram and you could have a much better view, especially if... And quite a lot of trams were also open top, so if it was on a nice sunny day, you got a suntan as well.
So why was it that they were electric-powered rather than, say, petrol-powered or whatever?
Because the post-First World War era, the manufacturers had worked out how to get efficient motors to fit between the axles. That's what the key is. It's exactly the same as the new trains you've got coming from Paddington, the electric service you've got coming from Paddington with the Hitachi 9000s. It's the ability of engineers to design effective motors to fit between the wheels. Now, you see, obviously, if you're 4'8½, you can use the same size motors as the railways were using.
So was there an attempt by private interest to take over these trams?
Yes, there were indeed. I mean, Coventry's trams, they were originally privately built and they went bust. And had it not been for the council bailing them out, buying the company out, a lot of people would have had to walk to work the next day.
What about some of the steeper streets in Bristol? For example, running past the BRI and up near St Michael's Hill. Obviously, St Michael's Hill itself is too steep. But how does a tram get up there? Just on, because it's only a metal wheel, isn't it? Surely it's going to slip as it's going up a hill full of passengers.
The secret is that when you start off, the power is divided into each individual axle. But when you get to about 20 miles an hour, you switch it over so that instead of having individual voltages, you switch it over. So therefore, the voltage is spread out, and that gives you better cruising speed, as opposed to start things, you get a very high horsepower but low speed.
Well, if you don't mind me saying so, you haven't really answered my question, because I mean, you would look at some of the streets in Bristol which ran trams and you think there's no way a train, for example, could get up there.
No, a train couldn't, because it's much heavier, much heavier unit. But certainly the Norwegians had for many years, they've still got a tram, an electric train service. It goes down 1 in 20, which is about what you got, the sort of hills you got in the Bristol area.
So does it come up again, or does it stay at the bottom?
Oh, yes, it came up again. You've got to bring the tourists back up, you know.
Okay, so the trams were pretty much closed down after the war in the 1950s, early 50s, late 40s.
Most of them, they were just worn out. Because there was no standard gauge, you couldn't make a standard tram that fitted all the networks.
But I mean,
it
was part of a national policy. What was the rationale behind closing the trams?
I think a lot of it was that the government was very keen to export, because obviously at the end of the war, the country was broke, and we had to do anything that would generate exports so that we could be paid in gold, so to speak, in a gold convertible currency. But the biggest problem with trams is they were just literally worn out. And if they'd all had the same gauge, then they could have easily had a modern standard tram which would have kept on the work. I think the other problem that trams got is the heavier the vehicles, the more damage it was doing to the roads, the sewers and the ducting underneath the roads.
I know the British Transport Commission came out with a report saying that trams cause congestion, and they were saying, obviously, they were wealthy people in their cars in the 1950s finding a tram in the way.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of truth in that, as car ownership became more widespread, trams were seen as the real problem. The real problem, of course, is you've got all these HGVs on the road which weren't paying anything like a fair amount of road fund tax. And also, you've also got the problem because you've got lots of cars coming on the road. Trams tend to go down the centre of roads, so if you want to get on and off, you have to cross a busy road to jump on the tram and jump off.
OK, so there was an attempt also to try and replace trams to a certain extent using those overhead wires with trolley buses, but that didn't last very long.
Again, the problem with trolley buses was the weight of them. Because they were basically buses, they were chassis-built buses, which were very, very strong, but it was the total weight of them didn't make them attractive. I mean, there is actually no reason why trolley buses could not have continued for another 50 years. I mean, if you put trolley buses back with the current motors you've got available, you would have a very powerful vehicle that was relatively lightweight.
I mean, this is one of the frustrations, isn't it, that we get trolley buses and trams all over the continent, but not here. Why is that?
No. Well, the road lobby didn't want them, pure and simple. The road lobby thought, well, the more of these we can get off, the more lorries we can get on, and the more cars we can have, because they thought, well, that makes us money. Because the other thing about public transport is the vehicles are built to last. I mean, nothing unusual. If we went back before the war, there'd be nothing unusual about seeing a 30 or 40 year old tram on the road, doing its job every day.
The thing is that now, though, we've got so many cars, they're talking about congestion charges. Well, they're not just talking about it, they're doing it. Here in Bristol, we're having a diesel ban. And in London, of course, every time you go into the centre now, you've got to pay.
Congestion charge is not and never has been the answer. The answer is you've got to make the lorries, the commercial vehicles, pay the true cost of using the road. And by the way, don't forget that buses effectively get the rebate on their fuel duty. So they are also running on way below the market price.
I mean, anyone talking about transport in Bristol will have to talk about First Group and First Bus. They've just announced a fivefold increase in profits, Chris. Do you think it really makes any difference if you have it privatised or nationalised, the buses?
The privatisation, the way the privatisation was done, was literally just to make easy profits for the owners. The biggest problem that all cities have got, where they've got private buses, you've got little or no control over the routes they operate, the fares they charge, or even getting coordination on timetables. For example, in Coventry, we have an express bus service from the city centre to Warwick University, run by Travel West Midlands, which was the old Civic company, which was privatised. Now, Stagecoach have now put on their competitive service, which means you've got buses running empty, all the way to Warwick University and back, or near empty, and that's absurd. Now, if we kept the powers, if the councils had kept the powers, things like that would not be happening.
Do you think people will see trams come back to Bristol? Some happened in many cities across Britain, or quite a few.
The problem is putting the track back in, because you've got to shift these services underneath. We found this out in the West Midlands with Metro 1 from Snowhill up to Wolverhampton. Now, fortunately, most of that runs on the old Great Western Northern Main Line, but the bits that go on the streets, which is from New Street and the halfway into Wolverhampton, there's a lot of work. The roads had to be dug up and services moved. To be able to get the trams in there, and that is not cheap. I think the other problem with trams is, of course, because the tracks are fixed, it's very difficult to move them if you say got a new estate. That's one of the reasons I'm in favour of trolley buses, because trolley buses drop you off at the curve. If you've got, say, a new housing estate, it's relatively simple. All you've got to do is put wires up, let's say, and then the buses, then all they've got to do is just, the driver just literally, puts the trafficator on to turn left or right, and just goes all the way round to the terminus, and then just change ends to drive his trolley bus back into town.
So, I mean, they're fashionable on the continent. They're very fashionable, particularly places like Switzerland. You've got a tram coming literally every 5-10 minutes. And, you know, it's almost as if people don't have to look at the timetable at all. They're just always a tram there.
Well, that's the same. That's the same in Manchester and Birmingham and other places out. But I mean, you go to Nottingham and you go to Sheffield, you see how many empty trams you've got, and they are blocking the roads. If all the trams are full, they do take an enormous amount of traffic off the road. But that's what we haven't got.
Oh, that's awful, isn't it? To have empty trams blocking the road.
Yeah, but you also got to remember, on the continent, all the big cities have got trams. A lot of the medieval areas were knocked down and good quality Victorian architecture was put up, and the roads were wide enough to have trams down them. That's the other big difference.
We can't talk to you in Birmingham, Chris, without mentioning HS2. We've just had a decision by central government. I think it's over £100 billion it's going to cost. Anyway, do you think it's money well spent?
It's an appalling, scandalous waste of public money. I'm sure anyone who uses their libraries regularly, they go and get a book out on the groundnut scheme that was planned for Kenya and the Commonwealth, where somebody had a bright idea: let's grow groundnuts, which of course we call peanuts, and they got all this thing out, and it was just a giant flop because they just didn't understand the land they were trying to farm. And HS2 is exactly, if people knew who was behind HS2, they would not be jumping up and down.
So who is behind it?
Who was behind it? It was when Intercity was run by somebody called Dr. John Prideaux. And that's where the idea comes from. And you speak to any other senior staff on the railways about Dr. Prideaux, they'll tell you he's very good on paper. You know, he was former director of research for BR. And it's also they're in breach of their own rules and government rules. The government rules must make it quite clear: if you want to increase capacity, you have to reopen closed lines wherever possible. Now, you already have a high-speed service. Well, something else you can't get through to these people: you have a high-speed service from London to Manchester and London to Leeds. It's called the West Coast Main Line and the East Coast Main Line. If you look at the speeds on there during the distance and compare it to most continental lines, it's years ahead of what they've got on the continent. Right, the continents have the odd, you go to France, obviously they've got the TGV lines, but most railways in France, do not run at TGV speeds. They run at 65-70 mile an hour, which, is a world of difference in trying to get from A to B.
So why has HS2 happened then, if it's not actually following the rules and it's not going to really bring benefits?
Well, that's what nobody can find out, because you're not only are you going to knock down lots of ancient woodland and bulldoze people's houses and long tunnels and all the rest of it, nobody has double-decker trains going at 250 mile an hour. Because this is what they're actually saying. The other thing that nobody tells you about is that the current intercity service, if HS2 is opened, Wolverhampton, Dudley, Sandwell and Coventry will lose their current intercity service, because we're all expected to get in our cars. We've got to get to the new station at Birmingham International. It's on the other side of the site, so it's a mile away from the current station. Now, so that's going to take you, at least 30 minutes to get there. You've got to buy a paper and a ticket, etc. That means instead of being 45 minutes, it's an hour and a quarter, an hour and 20. That's what the service was 60 years ago.
What you're saying is that it's not actually going to connect up with the main Birmingham station, Birmingham New Street. Is it going to connect up with the station for Eurostar in London, for example? I mean, this is obvious. You've got to have those connections, otherwise it's definitely not worth doing it.
No, they're going to try and put the platforms in at the side of Euston. They've knocked down some listed buildings to do it. Well, the absurdity is, why aren't they running them into St Pancras, which is where HS1 starts? But I mean, with regards to HS2, the worst thing of all is the amount of money they're wasting. HS2 actually costs about $35 billion to build. The rest of it is all consultancy, you know, days out at the races, 10-hour lunches at the Ritz, leasing horrendously overpriced trains. I mean, look, one thing the French have got right is the TGV system does work and it's popular. And it doesn't cause all the upsets that HS2 has. So why don't they actually go to the French and the Germans, the German ICE lines, and find out how to do it without getting up everyone's noses? Now, there already is a high-speed line to the north, which was closed, called the Great Central. It goes from Marylebone to currently just terminates at Aylesbury. To reopen that is very easy because nearly all the infrastructure is there. And that could easily be upgraded to 125. For the money they were proposing to waste, I could reopen the Great Western Main, Northern Main Line, all the way to Wigan Northwestern and upgrade it to 125 miles an hour. I could reopen the Midlands Peak Forest route to Manchester and again upgrade that to 125. Do the Settling Carlisle and then up to Carlisle, then use the other route to Glasgow into the old St Enoch's, and you'd still have change left for everyone to have bags of chips.
What I've heard from Manfred Petrish, who runs the All Smoke and Mirrors blog, he's based in Abkhazia, but he's a former Swiss financier who financed railways. When I put it to him that this was about 18 months ago, that it was going to be $111 billion, one of the latest estimates for HS2, he said, for that, you could build a railway around the world.
Yeah, he's right. He's absolutely right. It's a lot more to do with management consultants sticking their noses in the troughs. Management consultants have more power in the boardroom than anyone possibly realises. You know, they've got power over companies beyond Tony Benn's wildest dreams. and they've got this idea that somehow the rest of the world will be rushing to buy all their management consultancy and technology. Now, the biggest flaw of it of all is that the civil service only look at station to station, not door to door. Now, door to door, I am at everyone in Coventry, Sandwell and Dudley and Wolverhampton are going to be worse off. To get to London on this new service is going to take us the same time as it did in the steam era, but without the pleasure of travelling behind steam engines and hauling coaches that are actually comfortable to sit in.
Yeah, and having proper restaurant cars and all that
sort of thing.
Yes. Anyway, I'm not quite sure how we got from Bristol trams to Birmingham lack of an interchange for HS2. But anyway, always a pleasure to speak to you.
It is. Look, one of the most sensible things they did in the Bristol, and I know that Peter Parker was slagged off for this, was building Bristol Parkway. When it was first opened, first couple of years, very few people were using it now. But, I mean, you can look at how many people are using Bristol Parkway now, especially if they want to go to the north end of Bristol, or they say, drive in from Wales and jump on the train there to go to Paddington. You know, it's a very, very popular station, and thankfully they've replaced one of the original Great Western bridges with a modern bridge, so you should be able to have four tracks back into Temple Meads again, which would allow you to significantly increase the number of intercity trains and particularly holiday expresses.
Well, we're living in the age of the car, really, not the age of the train. But do you think we'll ever be returning to an era where the train becomes more affordable? Because the thing I hear from everybody, Chris, I talk to about railways is if it was cheaper than the car, I'd use it.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right, mate. Because it's the way the privatisation was structured, you've got vast increases in number of highly paid gaffers. You've got all these directors on fat cat bonuses, and that's before you start counting the number of accountants they employ. I remember the first year of this privatisation, Pete Waterman was giving a speech, and he said, the current railway operation system now has an accountant for every 5 miles of track. And he was absolutely right. And all the rail executives in the room went very quiet.
Chris Hewitt, always a pleasure to chat to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen to on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like, at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Chris Hewitt and Tom Dewey, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. We're based at People's Republic of Stoatscroft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us. Or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain, via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. I'm Ella Mapes, wishing you a very good week.
It's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga choo choo?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine. I've got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four. Read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blow and eight to the bar, then you'll know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shovel all the coal in, gotta keep it rolling.
Woo woo, Chattanooga, there you are.
There's gonna be a certain party at the station.
Satin and lace.
I used to call Funny Face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never roam.
So Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
all aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga, Chattanooga choo-choo.